What's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning!
Okay, well, it's going to have to you and Tom Cruise do it. My name is Jared. Today, we are joined by the rest of the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Austin.
Yo.
And Jacob.
Hello, hello.
And we have a very special guest today joining us from the Vsauce 2 YouTube channel and also the Create Unknown podcast. We got Kevin Lieber. What's up, Kevin?
Oh, not much. How are you guys doing?
Great. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to talking all things Big and Lebowski.
Oh, indeed. All right, so today we're talking about The Big Lebowski, the 1998 movie written and directed by the Coen brothers, starring Jeff Bridges, John Goodman, and Julianne Moore. As always, let's go around and get first impressions. What was it like, if you guys can reach back into your memory and remember, what was it like watching the first time, and what was it like revisiting it for this podcast? Let's start with Jacob.
Wow. Okay, so I remember the trailer so clearly. I think I must have seen Fargo, maybe? Or like, what was I seeing in theaters? Maybe it was actually before Saving Private Ryan. They had the trailer for The Big Lebowski in 98. Okay. Is that about right? And anyway, I remember seeing it as a kid saying, oh, I loved Kingpin, one of my favorite movies of all time. And I was like, oh, here's a movie about bowling. I can't wait. But it was a very, very mysterious trailer if you've ever seen it. It's like there's nothing at all is revealed. Did not see it in theaters, but I saw it. I would have been like 12 or 13 years old, so super inappropriate, but I saw it early when it was on home video, and I could not believe how many times the word fuck came up. I was like, what the heck?
Yeah.
And my mom was like, what are you watching? I don't think I really pieced together the movie and like the brilliance of it. It took a long time to like kind of get it and let it sink in. But I remember just feeling gravitated toward it and quoting it almost immediately. And so I loved it then. Just watched it again yesterday, probably the 40th or 50th time I've seen it.
Yeah.
I literally know every morsel of the movie, and I love it. And I loved it again. I love it. It's great. It's great. And there's so many decisions at every point that I'm like, is that intentional too? And why is that so good? And it's just great. It's imminently, imminently quotable.
To bring in a serious man. Okay, cool. What about you, Austin?
Oh, fuck, man. I have no clue the first time I saw it. Again, I've seen this so many times. You know, my buddy Troy that I do the Owls at Dawn podcast with, this is his favorite movie. So at university, it was always streaming. So I have no fucking clue. I've seen it so many times. It's almost not even like, I don't even view it as a film. I just view it as a part of my cultural life, if that makes sense. But yeah. It had been a few years since I'd seen it. So watching it last night was actually really enjoyable. You know, I'm in the throngs of writing my book, so every day for me right now is just intense writing. And this was a really lovely reprieve to just go home and laugh. And I don't remember laughing as much, and I think maybe it's just because I was in a state of delirium. But I think it's fucking fantastic. I love that there's an entire religion, you know, based on Judaism. I think that at a surface level, you can just enjoy this film very simply, but then at the same time, there are also some really interesting deep dives. There's some amazing references, and there's some interesting sort of ideological clashes, and obviously, clearly, the Coen brothers are philosophically astute, so I'm going to nerd out on some of that shit. But I just think it's a fucking great movie at all levels, from the sort of superficial to the deep and philosophical as well.
Awesome. Well, I hope you are keeping your mind limber with a strict drug regimen as you write your book. Kevin, what about you? Can you remember the first time you saw it?
No, and I'm immediately fascinated now by the fact that none of us can. So maybe this movie like didn't exist and just sort of was like injected into our like the milieu at some point. I don't know how it first was conceived because I spent all day trying to think of the first time that I watched it, and I came up empty. It was definitely one of the first DVDs I ever bought, because whenever
the hologram
it was
DVD,
that
I
saw
that.
It, I loved it immediately, and then I was the guy showing it to everyone else.
Did your friends get it?
Yeah, we all loved it. I mean, I think that, you know, I definitely got the DVD in high school and then brought it to college and then just showed it to everybody in college, and we watched it countless times, and I did rewatch it earlier today, actually, in preparation for talking about it, with kind of a critical lens a little bit, taking notes and thinking about it thematically and what each character represents. And even though I've seen the movie countless times, it was really kind of like watching it again sort of for the first time, because of, you know, just kind of like diving into what each character means, you know, without getting too pretentious about it. But I like doing that kind of thing.
Oh, well, that's what we do. That's what all we do here. Time.
Perfect.
Cool. Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but I actually do remember the first time I saw this movie. I was in Vail, Colorado, and I was out skiing with my friend's family, and I did not put sunscreen on and got debilitatingly sunburned, so I did not hit the slopes the second day. So instead, I went to the movies, and I watched The Big Lebowski with my mom, and
your mom.
Similar to you, like, the only thing I remember is, like, I can't believe how many times they say the word fuck. That's the only thing I think I came away with. I didn't get it at all. I think, if I remember correctly, the only time my mother and I laughed was at the end when Donnie's ashes get blown back into the dude's face. We couldn't stop laughing
the
at that part.
The most slapstick part. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But I didn't get it for years. In fact, it was an inside joke between my mom and I that it was the worst movie we had ever seen. And then some point in high school, I rewatched it and I started to get it. And I hesitate to use the word get it because I don't really know what that means in that content. I don't really know what that means in that context, but I guess you just find yourself in tune with the rhythm of the comedy. I found myself in it. I get it. Yeah. I see why this is funny. I don't know if it was just before its time. I don't know what was going on. But
well,
of course,
I've heard it said that it's less a film about concepts and more about attitude. And I think if you don't vibe with that attitude, you don't fully get to immerse yourself in the overall affect, you know? And you gotta feel like, that's why I think the VO at the beginning is so important, to really soak in. And if you can get his voiceover at the beginning and you can vibe yourself with it, then you can kind of like slip into the attitude.
It's kind of like when I would watch, when I was a young kid, I would watch all the Cheech and Chong movies, and I thought they were so funny, but I didn't even know what weed was.
Right.
So later in life, once I knew what weed was, I'd rewatch it, and I'm like, oh, this is why this is funny. And then I kind of had a similar experience with this.
That's one of my favorite parts about getting older, just rewatching stuff, and you're like, oh my God, I completely missed this joke.
Yeah.
It's so much funnier with this layer, obviously.
Yeah, my innocent enjoyment of so many like fucking National Lampoon movies and shit like that is totally like transfigured now as I rewatch them, and I'm like, oh my God, like I didn't even realize that that was sexual, or I didn't even realize that that was, you know, some sort of like political or sociocultural statement. And yeah, it's pretty funny to do that.
Yeah. So I've seen the movie like 50 times, of course, in college a lot of times. I mean, it's just so good. But anyway, guys, let's go into a recap. So, Jeffrey Lebowski, a.k.a. The Dude, is minding his own business one day when two men break into his apartment and pee on his rug, mistaking him for another much wealthier Jeffrey Lebowski, whose wife owes money to a notorious pornographer named Jackie Treehorn. So, at the behest of his friend Walter, the dude appeals to the real Jeffrey Lebowski to get his rug replaced. Mr. Lebowski rudely denies his request and throws him out, but the dude takes a rug anyway. Soon the dude is brought before Mr. Lebowski and informed that Mr. Lebowski's wife Bunny has been kidnapped for ransom. They ask the dude to act as courier and give the kidnappers the money. En route to drop off the money, Walter, the dude's friend, decides to throw a ringer and botches the entire exchange. The dude's car is then stolen with the money in it. The dude is then interrogated by Mr. Lebowski's daughter Maud, who wants him to retrieve the money on her behalf. The dude recovers the car, but the briefcase with the money in it is nowhere to be found. He discovers the thief is a teenager named Larry Sellers. Walter and the dude question Larry, but are stonewalled. The dude then meets Jackie Treehorn, is thrown out, and sleeps with Maud. When he has an epiphany, there was never any money in the briefcase. The Big Lebowski wanted Bunny to be killed and wanted to use the dude as a patsy. Bunny comes back from what turned out to be a vacation in Vegas, and the dude goes back to bowling, but not before the kidnappers burn down the dude's car and give their friend Donnie a heart attack. After giving Donnie a heartfelt send-off, the dude and Walter go back to bowling. End of movie.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get him out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
All right, guys, so I think it behooves us to initially, let's talk about the legacy of this film and the fandom, because
it's exploded.
Usually, we tend to stay pretty textual, which we'll get to, but this is certainly a special thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's Lebowski Fest, which is, I've been to, they're all over the country. There's multiple ones in different cities. I went to the one in LA a couple of years ago, and Jeff Bridges was actually there.
Oh, right.
He's written a book on
Dudism. Yeah, he co-authored the book on Dudism, didn't he?
Right.
Like Dudism and Taoism or something like that?
Right. And then, I think that's right, exactly, or the Tao of Dude or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
And you've got the Church of Latter-day Dude, and you've got, I mean,
that's my favorite name.
Weddings.
I was at a wedding just a couple months ago, and it was an ordained minister of the Church of Latter-day Dude was the officiator of the wedding.
I just married my sister like a couple of months ago. I should have gotten ordained by the Church of Latter-day Dudes.
Absolutely.
Oh, man.
I kind of thought you might have.
Oh, that's a big fail on my part. No, I've actually been ordained for a long time because of my old past. But, you know, they also have like all kinds of bars that are themed after Lebowski's. My favorite bar in Glasgow on the west side is a bar called Lebowski's. And basically they have like 40 different types of signature cocktails, the standard kind. And all the drinks are named after things from the show, you know, the Nihilist, the Toe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And each one of them is a sort of different take. You know, this one has chocolate in it. This one has whatever else in it. And it's probably my favorite bar in all of Scotland. And it's I used to go there all the time. It's amazing, man.
The book is called Zen and the Art of Bowling, by the way. Thanks, Nigel.
So why do you guys think this movie has resonated on such a level?
I would say that it's something to do with the attitude of fuck it, let's go bowling. There's like this ultimate sort of surrender to pressure, you know, wars, a whole bunch of crap goes on, and it's this attitude of dudes, or I guess really that's Walter, but like it's this attitude of just complete shenanigans and randomness and chaos and just sort of a complete absurdity to it all of like in the face of all that pressure. Fuck it, dude. Let's just go bowling. And I think there's something about that resignation that sort of resonates a lot. And then the quirkiness of the characters. I mean, there's so much to the actual comedy, but I think if I were to put it in a nutshell, that's the part that resonates the most with me is just the attitude, kind of to your point, Austin, earlier.
Hmm.
Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah.
Well, I think for me, you know, why it resonated so well with me to begin with is that it really seems like a study of how everybody is a little bit weird and everybody has their own goals and they're using each other for different reasons and no one is really being truthful and it's really about everyone around the dude, and the dude is just kind of like in the center. He is like the center cosmos of this crazy world. And it reminds me a lot of A Confederacy of Dunces, which is my favorite book, where that book very much is about the characters around the main character and what they represent kind of in society. And The Big Lebowski to me very much is about the early 90s and what was going on and all of like the different struggles that depending on your upbringing and what you lived through, whether it was like Vietnam or, you know, you were a baby boomer or a former hippie, you know, leads you down different paths.
Hmm.
Interesting. Were you going to say something, Austin?
Oh, I was just going to say it's tough to put your finger on it, I think.
Yeah.
I think because it is such a mood film, it's such an attitude film, it's almost like any portrayal of it through words is like a betrayal of it. You kind of just have to immerse yourself in it. But I think it's because there are all these discontinuities. And I love what Kevin just said about the cosmos and how Lebowski, the dude, is the center of this cosmos. But then I wonder, because the title of the film is The Big Lebowski, what do you think the title refers to? Does it refer to the dude? Does it refer to Lebowski? Is it sort of a juxtaposition of the two?
Can I quote Earthling Cinema?
Yeah.
So the film is loosely based on Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep, going so far as to steal to plagiarize two words of the title.
So that's, we'll get into that a little bit later, but it's basically the whole movie is a play off noir conventions, and the the movie is the title is a play on The Big Sleep.
Okay, interesting. But why not the big dude?
Big,
because the name really ties the movie together.
Because because big is, yeah, exactly.
Well said.
All right. So there's actually an essay. So Jacob has a friend who is a
he's the chair of religious studies at University of Charleston, I think.
Who wrote a whole book on the Coen brothers and religion, and this is actually a chapter in his book. Written by Erica Hurwitz Andrus, and it's about fandom in the Big Lebowski, and I actually have some quotes here.
We can put some links in the description.
Yeah, we can put some links in the description. So she distinguishes between two different kinds of fandom. So there are the achievers, which are the Lebowski Fest roadies, basically. Mm-hmm. They go to every Lebowski Fest. And then there are the dudists, who literally think of it as a religion. They follow dudism and the Church of the Dude. So this is what she says, why she thinks, or as from her studying the achievers and the dudists, what she thinks is why the film resonates so much. She says, the common thread in both fan responses to the film is an understanding of the dude as an exemplar of authenticity in a world of materialistic, competitive, ultimately meaningless American alienation. Both the achievers and the dudists use the film to create a world in which they can use humor, irony, and self-expression to challenge a culture that assumes life must be serious, competitive, and purpose-driven. So I found that to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, it seems like because there's this sense of, well, first of all, there's like a sense of belonging just in being part of the achievers or part of the church. But like to Austin's point, like this whole world is, or is it maybe it was Kevin's point, the whole world is happening around the dude and he remains this sort of one, I wouldn't say calm, but this one consistent piece of this puzzle as things are swirling around him.
Yeah, there's a gravitas there.
Yeah, and what we're seeing demonstrated is how do you respond to all this craziness in the world? And I think that there was another piece around in that book about masculinity, extreme masculinity, and these quick postures for power, and just the dude is just sort of very chill throughout. Like he's saying, he remains relatively calm, except for when he's freaking out. They're going to kill that poor woman.
I have to keep stopping myself from quoting the movie because I told Jacob before this, I'm like, I'm going to put an embargo on quoting the movie too many times.
We do have someone here who does say that they have a ringtone on their phone that says, phone's ringing, dude.
Oh, that's so good.
One thing that I noticed today is just how incredibly selfish everybody is except for the dude and Donnie. But I mean, Donnie is just so helpless that he can't really do anything for anyone. Like, Donnie is just relegated to almost non-existence. Like, he's just so in the background that no one's even listening. But the dude somehow is selfless. He will go to like his landlord's stupid one-man show, right? Nobody else really is kind of doing anything for anybody else. I mean, I guess Walter helps out the dude, but Walter quickly turns the dude's problems or his achievements into his own. Like when he says, like, we need this. It's only, why should we settle for 20 grand? And the dude's like, why we? So, even the Walter is using the dude, but the dude doesn't really seem to use anyone.
And Walter, yeah, and Walter's
totally
only showing up.
Which is fascinating. Everybody else has the self-interest, but the dude demonstrates that you can be an ethical being without necessarily needing to seek your own interests in the pursuit of those ethical ends. And that's fascinating,
Yeah, well, first thing, Walter is, he's using like this exchange. He reminded me a lot of Cartman when I watched it this time around. I was like, he's using it. He'll only go pick up the dude and do this deed because it's going to help the bowling, their tournament. He's going to be there for practice, and he needs that. Or he can make money on this thing. But the only time that you'd say that maybe the dude's morality is a bit in question is when he does ultimately say the guy said to take any rug in the house. The old man said to take any rug you'd like. That part.
Yeah, but fuck the Big Lebowski.
But fuck, yeah, I guess he's rich as shit and he's fine and he can afford this rug. But that's the only time really where the dude is a little more self-interested, it seems.
Have you guys heard the theory that Donnie isn't real? That he's just a figment of Walter's imagination?
I have not
heard that.
Yeah,
and
so
I hate those theories of like, who's actually a fight? I just like hate theories like this of like, I've heard that for Black Swan, like maybe the mother doesn't actually exist, but I'm sorry, keep going.
No, it's just that maybe Donnie is a figment of Walter's imagination. That's one of his buddies from Nam that was killed, that's constantly haunting him. That's why he's constantly like, shut up, Donnie, and shit like that. Because, you know, the bowling teams are teams of two, but there are three of them. The dude doesn't really ever pay attention to Donnie, except maybe to sort of like humor Walter, is how it's understood. So, I've heard it. And then I guess it was actually brought up to the Coen brothers, and they were kind of like, no, that's not true at all.
Interesting.
So
I want to read one more quote from Erica Andrus. She says that this is why people find religious meaning in The Big Lebowski. She says, it might be a question of a religion masquerading as a joke rather than a joke masquerading as a religion. This distinction fits perfectly with the activities of Lebowski fans because at the core of, quote, play lies the paradox of acting insincerely but with earnestness. And this is the paradox of the dude. His life seems to be meaningless and aimless, but therein lies his profoundly meaningful authenticity. I'm just going to get through this. Just so we can move on. The dude offers imaginative, vicarious respite in a chaotic, demanding world and reminds us of important values, including friendship. So I found her insights as to why the film resonates to the crazy extent that it has to be pretty interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's got like a really simple life, right? He just needs some white Russians, some bowling, and some friends. And yeah, he's annoyed that his rug got taken away, but he's kind of like the Epicurean in that he, yeah, there's an element that he's trying to minimize suffering, but he's not really seeking these extravagant pleasures. It's a very simple form of pleasure seeking, and he just needs that minimal standard, and then he's fucking good. And then everything else on top of that is just gravy, you know? Like, hey, if he's getting laid, that's cool, but it's not like he's craving it or striving after it, you know? So he's an interesting embodiment of Stoic philosophy and Epicurean philosophy, and I think that juxtaposed to like the severity of the global geopolitical and political economic background with the Iraq War, and then of course, you know, all the other things around them, nihilism, and Walter has his diatribe about how Jesus Christ, you know, say what you will about the National Socialists, but at least it's an ethos. So I mean, there are these interesting juxtapositions that the film is exploring.
And I did find online, reading like the Stoic readings of the film, and then of course it's right up against the nihilism, which is pretty present, at least as the characters are concerned.
And one thing I noticed with the rug is that he wasn't going to do anything. The dude wasn't even going to do anything about that until Walter really stoked that fire in him.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
And Walter was like, "Yo, it's the Big Lebowski," and then that's really what set off the dude onto this crazy rabbit hole
that goes down.
It wasn't the dude.
Yeah. That's a really good point.
And kind of ends up back where he started in a sense, right? Like nothing really happened. This whole, I think that's sort of typical of the Raymond Chandler stuff, is that like these big stories with very complicated plot ensue, but nothing ever happens. It's just really all about character. So really nothing has really changed for the dude. I mean, he's lost Donnie. That's the biggest change for him as a character. But yeah, if it weren't for Walter stoking that fire for him to go do this thing and engage in this stupid plot, nothing would be any different.
And that's the opposite of the hero's journey. Like the hero's journey, you need the lead character to cross the threshold, him or herself. And in The Big Lebowski, Walter just chucks him over the threshold, essentially.
My favorite reading of one of my favorite moments of the film that kind of speaks to the challenge of reading this film or the ultimate message of their, not being any grand meanings to derive from it, is when Jackie Treehorn scribbles something on a piece of paper, takes it off, walks away, and then the dude traces the pencil over it, and it's just a picture of a dude with a dick.
Right.
And I'm like, I feel like that's me analyzing this movie or trying to analyze this movie. I'm like trying to look beneath the surface, but every time you do, there's just a guy with a dick laughing at you for trying to do it.
That's great. Very apt.
Yeah.
And that also must have been a direct, satire of those hard-boiled, like, noir films, where he was supposed to discover some great clue by doing that, and look what the clue ended up being. Nothing.
Right. Yeah, so the movie is a sort of parody on the Raymond Chandler novel slash film The Big Sleep. And yes, more to Kevin's point, instead of a hard-drinking, rough-around-the-edges, tough private eye Philip Marlowe, who is the character in a number of Raymond Chandler's books, we get the exact opposite, a super laid-back stoner. And I think that's basically the comic conceit that motivates the whole movie. Another thing in noir that is worth talking about is that a lot of times in noir, protagonists are always stuck in the past. So let's say in Chinatown, the character Jake Giddies is haunted by a woman he got close to who was killed back when he patrolled Chinatown. And if you go through noir films, there's always something like this. And a lot of it has to do with a lot of war stories that are that haunt these people. And similarly, in this film, everyone is trapped in their past, but it's kind of like a joke. So the dude is kind of stuck in the hippie flower power movement of the 60s. Walter, of course, is stuck in Vietnam, also stuck in his marriage, because he still considers himself to be Jewish. I've heard people say that Jackie Treehorn is stuck in the glory days of Hugh Hefner, and Maude is stuck in the Fluxus art movement.
Hmm. And then the Big Lebowski is stuck in this wealthy kind of memory of himself, this sham.
But he never was wealthy, right?
Where did all that money come from again?
His wife is super wealthy, yeah. And that's Maude's mother.
Mm-hmm.
So he married into the wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that's a really clever kind of adjustment of noir convention is that, as I mentioned earlier, most noir franchises were set against World War II, or at least reflecting on the effects of World War II. This is set against the Gulf War, which is pretty much like the laid-back stoner of wars. Because it was like super low stakes. It didn't really accomplish much.
Mm. Mm. That is really interesting. I'm not as familiar with the noir genre. Because even like Chinatown would be neo-noir, right? Because noir kind of ends in what, the 60s?
70s.
70s?
I think the movie came out in the 70s. But yeah, the noir was at its peak, or at least most prolific, in the 40s and 50s.
40s and 50s, right. So that is interesting. I mean, I kind of thought that there was, and it was just something that I was drawn to this time. And maybe it was because I just recently watched Buster Scruggs on Netflix. And so I was thinking about this film through that film being like an answer to the Coens, or to the accusation that the Coens are misanthropes, right? And so in The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, they're kind of like intentionally showing a sort of extreme humanist side. You know, a couple of the vignettes are just so touching and so sincere and so authentic in their exploration of the human experience. And then I'm trying to think, okay, I wanted to read Lebowski then through the criticism. Are they just misanthropes? And I kind of saw the setup as being this weird, misanthropic, anti-Western. And I don't know, what do you think about that? I mean, do you think it's a sort of revisionist Western in a way as well? I mean, obviously the Sam Elliott character lends itself to that. But even the beginning with this tumbleweed that's kind of just gently being blown, but rather than it being the hero's journey, as Kevin said, it's this anti-hero, apathetic kind of, he's not a misanthrope, but he just is uninterested. But nevertheless, the portrayal of all the humans around him are kind of misanthropic. You don't really get this great sense that the Coens are humanists, you know?
And the stranger does at the end, so the Sam Elliott character at the end also mentions, like, this is a story that kind of keeps coming and going, happens all the time since the first carts moved to the West for the pursuit of gold. I think he mentioned something like that. So, like, in this idea of, like, the pursuit for the West, I could see that, at least on the Western reading, that being pretty interesting.
So I wrote down that quote because that really stuck out to me as well as summing up the entire film. And it was, the human comedy perpetuates itself down the generations. And I think that that is in line with the tumbling tumbleweeds. It's in line with basically the fuck it, let's go bowling attitude. Because no matter what's going on, no matter who you are, and no matter what troubles you have, you know, the human comedy perpetuates itself down the generations. Life goes on. That's another quote.
And the wind will blow you around.
They just say at one point, you know, life goes on. and it does, even if your best friend's ashes just got blown in your beard.
And tumbleweeds don't exist in LA, right? I mean, I've been here 7 years. Like, that just doesn't happen out here, especially moving down to Malibu, like tumbling all the way down to the beaches of Malibu.
Well, that's what's so interesting, because the tumbleweed comes from the desert over the hills into the city, right?
Yeah.
It seems like Sam Elliott's character is... I think it's clear that the Coens love Westerns.
Yeah,
probably,
of course.
That's probably the genre they grew up watching, and it seems like we're seeing a stoner noir film through a Western frame is how I would call it.
And I just thought about, like, as an outsider, too, like, the idea of a tumbleweed doesn't exist here in L.A., yet somehow it's here on the shore. It's just sort of rolled up, and the wind has carried it here just like the wind is carrying in these strangers and stories.
But yeah, I always thought of the tumbling tumbleweed as kind of a visual metaphor for him and how he just abides.
Because,
you know, he doesn't strive. He doesn't achieve. He's not a nihilist. He's not a Brother Seamus. He just is.
He's just being blown by the wind.
He just goes with the flow.
And that's like what Kevin's point was. Like, it takes Walter to push him across the line, right? Like, he doesn't go across the line. He has, like, he doesn't care about the injustice. Walter does. Walter's the wind that blows him into the story. That's what starts the inciting event that then... creates the unfolding of the story. It's the wind that blows the dude into it. But then this is interesting, because then it makes me think that, okay, so the dude is sort of this embodiment of a spirit that exists throughout time. He's like the embodiment of the out of placeness, or of the kind of like recurrence of the same. And so you get this tumbleweed as this metaphor that's kind of introducing a foreign element. But the reason it's a foreign element isn't because it's... like completely extra worldly or supernatural, but it's just, it's always being blown around and it's kind of floating through all of the scenes. We're just not always aware of it. It seems like the stranger, but that's only because we've constructed our worlds to like hide from against the natural tumbleweed. I mean, because Los Angeles is built in the fucking middle of the desert, you know? And so it's kind of like this idea that you have this eternal recurrence of the same that kind of just blows through the sands of time, you know? But we just don't always pay attention to it. And the dude is like the full embodiment of that repetition.
And you haven't even mentioned what you're dressed as right now.
I'm dressed as Walter. So for those who are not on the live stream, I'm Walter. I'm fucking Shomer Shabbos. Thank God it's not Shabbos, because I wouldn't be here.
Like, I mean, how many John Goodman costumes costumes that John Goodman wore did they sell in a Halloween store?
Oh, my God.
This has got to be the only one.
Yeah, this is it. This is the one.
Yeah.
Where do you think this film stands in the Coen Brothers filmography? I mean, but besides it just being iconic, it might be the most famous, but like in terms of quality, like, do you think, like, what are your guys' thoughts on that?
Well, this is Kevin's favorite one, right?
It is my favorite, just because, I mean, what constitutes a favorite? For me, it's rewatchability. And with The Big Lebowski, I mean, I can just clearly rewatch it like infinite times. You know, maybe I'll do 1A, 1B with No Country for Old Men.
That's my favorite,
and then
probably
stick Fargo at 2, and then go from there. But
I forgot about Fargo for a second there. My God. Yeah.
What's that?
So I forgot about Fargo for a second. I was like, oh, yeah, No Country for Old Men, Serious Man. I was like, wait, of course. So your list again would be Big Lebowski, then No Country, then Fargo?
Well, I think No Country probably would be 1B, because I'm not a person who goes to the theater twice to see a movie, but I went to the theater twice to see No Country for Old Men because it had that effect on me. I had to go back. So, yeah, I think 1A, 1B, and then number 2, or I guess that would make it number 3, I don't know, would be Fargo.
I've heard Burn After Reading is actually great. I saw it one time and didn't like it that much, but I heard it's excellent, actually. I need to rewatch that. And then True Grit was their top grossing film of all time, which is surprising.
Hmm. Yeah. I definitely feel like it's their most one of their more optimistic movies.
For sure.
They don't have a lot of optimistic movies, but I think even in they have an answer for how should one live life instead of just kind of resigning to misanthropy, as is perhaps evident in Buster Scruggs, but we could talk about that in a different podcast, but it's definitely evident in A Serious Man and
Barton Fink and a lot of these.
I mean, I think Fargo, we have a hero and an exemplar of human dignity in Marge Gunderson, but in this one, it is kind of like, all right, so there's a world of nihilists and fake achievers and all sorts of shit, and in order to get through life, you got to just abide. I feel like that's more of a positive statement than they often give.
Hmm. It's the Stoic sort of conclusion, right? Like there is like, it's giving you a sense of how to live your life with dignity.
Yeah. All right. So I wanted to talk about, so we touched a little bit on masculinity earlier. I don't really know what I make about this, but there's of course the scene where the Big Lebowski says, "What makes a man, Mr. Lebowski?" And of course,
is it being prepared to do the right thing, whatever the cost?
Yeah.
That and a pair of testicles.
But there are some interesting things that is done here with manhood. So first of all, there's the song, the Bob Dylan song that starts the movie, The Man in Me. Then there is the dude says that being a man is having a pair of testicles. And then the nihilists are threatening to not take off his testicles, but to cut off his
castration.
Johnson. The Big Lebowski seems to affirm masculinity through his ability to achieve. And then this one I like. The landlord is an interesting kind of take on that character archetype, because a lot of times in these hard-boiled detective stories, he's a domineering, like, "Where's my rent?"
kind of
guy. But instead, he's a tight shirt-wearing fat guy who does Mussorgsky interpretive dances. And then even the stranger. We talked a little bit about his voiceover at the beginning. Even the stranger subverts the kind of American ideal of masculinity. Or, I'm sorry, the idea being that... So there's actually two ideas I conflated here. So it's interesting how the voice of the stranger, you might hear his voice and expect to be introduced to a badass like John Wayne, but instead it's a guy who goes into the market and writes a 69-cent check for half and half.
Right.
Or cream, whatever it is.
In his bathrobe.
In his bathrobe, exactly. Now, what I was going to say about the stranger is an interesting thing about how it subverts the archetype of noirs. First of all, voiceover, especially in the 40s and 50s noir films, was a staple.
That kind of guy who talked like this. Was that guy?
Well, those are the villains.
Oh, right.
But just usually it's the protagonist with voiceover.
I had a story about this thing that happened.
But the stranger in the movie, he literally just is talking and he's like, "Well, I lost my train of thought, whatever." Which is more of just like, yeah. It's a noir film with a hit of weed.
I lost my train of thought there.
Or as Garrick Swarmeloid said, sprinkled with weed and Kahlua.
Yeah.
It's funny because you think that the film doesn't take itself seriously, right? Like, I've read a lot of stuff about this film and the death of meta-narrative, yada, yada, yada. But the interesting thing is that a lot of people in this film have these serious, like, ethics that they abide by. You've got Lebowski, the real Lebowski, who he clearly has some sort of ethic that he abides by. You've even got the nihilists who like seem to be, there's like at least a philosophy that they are ascribing to, even if Walter shits on it for saying that it's not really an ethos. But the point is that there's still something going on there, right? Then you've got Walter, who's clearly got this overinflated sense of justice. You've got these like surrounding themes that are constantly there. So it's almost like I'm not sure that the film is just a fuck it. The film is a sort of ethic, but it's like a temper your expectations about the ethics that you live by rather than there are no ethics.
Is fuck it not in itself an ethic?
I think it is. No, okay, it is.
One.
That's the thing, right? Like the declaration that there are no ethics is an ethic, right? And so to just be like, hey, let's just live simply – is still an ethic. It's just not, it's not the grandiose ethic that leads us to war, which is the backdrop of this film, right? Like, and it's a bullshit war as well. So I think that there's something in that, you know? It's kind of like a don't have these crazy expectations and think that somehow your shit is all that important. Fuck it. Go bowling.
Fuck, yeah. Getting really back to the masculinity thing for a second, I have some folks that Nerd of Anarchy is saying that Walter, you know, Walter sort of submitting to his wife's demands and having to talk about this Pomeranian and bringing her bowling and like being really at a weak point. Or the other piece that reminds me of is when he goes to talk to little Larry, you know, Walter again is like, he's there to intimidate. That's his job. Yet he like loses his cool, or he's like completely geeks out like, "Oh, I'm sorry. I have to tell you, really, I loved your work. You know, I thought you were fantastic in your first few early years." You know, he just completely breaks down and gets into like this giddy mode before getting into his tough spot and then completely melting down again.
Well, what I love about that scene is it seems like all he had prepared was, "Is this your homework, Larry?"
That's all he had.
And then as soon as that doesn't work, because he assumed that, oh, well, he's going to crack right after that, all he can do is just repeat, is this your homework, Larry? Have you ever heard of Vietnam?
Yeah.
You know, he goes
off the rails.
Right. It's like, well, shit, if this isn't working, the only other thing that pops to mind is Nam, of course. Yeah.
I just bought that car last week. Yeah. I'm sorry. I have to.
How can you not? I totally get it. So let's talk about, this is one of my favorite readings of the film is, and I think it's like half serious, is the dude as a Christ figure. So I don't know if people point this out to be trolly, but he has the hair, he dresses in a robe and sandals. He has taken a vow of poverty.
Well, that's a little extreme.
Right.
I had read it a little bit differently, more like his reaction, the fact that he's going to take it chill for the rest of us. He's going to take it easy for all of us. So the way that Jesus died for our sins, he will chill out for our sins. Like he will be our savior in that sense, you know?
Yeah.
And I can see that. I mean, I don't know about
I think that's a better reading.
Yeah. I don't think it's so much
about that, and it seems like the Coen brothers were completely conscientious of this because there's a character named the Jesus in the movie.
That's true,
right.
And he's not just Jesus, he's the Jesus, just like there's
the Jesus
dude. And
like, dude.
That's not an accident. But then they make the Jesus the most despicable character in a world of kind of
that's a good point.
Greasy people. Because he's literally a pedophile.
A pedophile.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because I always kind of struggle, like, what's the point of this character except for just like to add, you know, obviously a great song and some great tension at the bowling alley scenes. But yeah, that's interesting because they do set up Jesus as this sort of completely faulty character. And instead, I guess they propose the alternative.
Well, and it goes into your masculinity thing too, because he is like the... what would you say, like the pathological and like tyrannical sexual man, you know, like literally went to jail. Like he is that taken to like a disgusting, revolting extreme.
Like what he says, I'm going to fuck you in the ass.
Right. Yeah, everything that he does is sexualized.
Yeah, absolutely.
Including, you know, like the buffing of the balls.
you know who else is a great lens to talk about masculinity? And actually, this is probably one of the only new things I took away after this viewing is Philip Seymour Hoffman's
Brandt.
Yeah,
oh,
Brandt,
man,
the ultimate brown noser.
He's so good.
And of course, every time I see Philip Seymour Hoffman after his unfortunate death, I can't help but miss him. I always tell people that when the Trump movie happens, it should have been Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Man.
Can you imagine Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Trump? It would be the best thing ever.
It's amazing to see his career trajectory, too, from like Twister and this to then all of a sudden
so young.
He becomes this prestige actor. You know, I mean,
he
always, and then when I go back and watch those earlier roles, you realize that he wasn't just a goofy guy, because he did play like in Twister. He's like that kind of like that goofy, stonery kind of meteorologist storm chaser dude.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this, he's kind of like this awkward. But in terms of like as a technician, the talent has always been there. It's just amazing to see him finally get his due and get the roles that he can really sink his teeth into later on in his career.
But more to the masculinity point, he's always so geeked out and excited to point out Mr. Lebowski's accolades. It's the kind of guy who gleams with pride by looking at someone else's prizes. And when it comes to masculinity, he derives every element of his self-worth from worshiping the Big Lebowski. And to be crude about it, he is quite literally the Big Lebowski's bitch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And he's no dude that did not occur to us.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a complete extension of himself. Yeah, or of him. Like he derives all of his self-worth through that through his accolades, through what's hanging on his wall. Please don't touch that. Please don't.
Yeah. He probably knows the accolades better than the actual man himself.
In Django, is he the Steven of the house? And we just don't see that he's really the one pulling the strings behind the scene.
I don't know if there's evidence of that, but I like that. I like the idea of if, in fact, he did make money and the businesses that the Big Lebowski ran were profitable, I like the idea that Brandt is doing all the work.
I
couldn't help but think of Mr. Burns and Smithers with their relationship.
Oh, of course. That's great. Let's talk about... So we kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, but there is a sense of... You know, it's funny that we say that this movie is considered religious by some people, because it's almost as if the movie goes out of its way to soil things that are sacred. And I think this is more to the previous, I can't remember her exact name, the academic Erica that I was quoting earlier about. He said that instead of taking a joke as a religion, taking a religion as a joke, but things that are sacred are constantly being torn down in this movie. So, for example, sex. Maude has sex with the dude for contraception purposes, but have no intention of the dude having anything to do with the baby.
Conception purposes.
Right. To Kevin's point, someone named Jesus is a pedophile. Walter is a Jew claiming to be Shomer Shabbos, but he's really just a Catholic parading as a Jew to be close to his wife. Of course, there's the success. Jeff Lebowski has supposedly led a life of achievement, but it turns out he's a phony. And to Austin's point earlier, even the nihilist, which I guess you couldn't really say that nihilism is sacred in any way, but I find it funny that even they are revealed to be materialists like any other of us when they say they want the money, Lebowski. And then Walter's like, fair? Who's the fucking nihilist around here? And then Donnie's death. Donnie's death, it's one of their best friends. He nonchalantly dies of a heart attack, the most just non-climactic thing ever. And then they, of course, use the coffee can. And then And even the touching moment of the send-off is undercut by it blowing into Walt, into the dude's face. And I think it's things like this, the kind of relentless making a joke out of things that ought to be taken seriously, or at least we're told in society ought to be taken seriously, is really cathartic for people.
Can I tell you this amazing anecdote that I recently heard about? It's like one of these old Jewish, like, rabbinic tales. So it's this Jewish rabbi that's talking to this young man, and the young man comes to him and says, hey, Rabbi, I want to know all the wisdom in the world. Can you tell me, like, all, like, the wisdom of God or something like that? And the rabbi says, okay. He's like, you're not ready. He's like, I don't think I can do that. And the guy says, no, please, please. He says, okay, fine, I'll tell you. He says, two guys come down a chimney. He's like, one guy's got soot on his face. The other guy doesn't have soot on his face. Who cleans himself? Who washes his face? And the kid goes, well, obviously the guy with the soot on his face. The rabbi goes, no, he's like the guy that doesn't have soot on his face, because he looks at the guy that has soot on his face and he surmises that he must have soot on his face. So he washes his face. And then he says, I got another story for you. He says, two guys come down a chimney. One has soot on his face. The other doesn't have soot on his face. Who washes his face? And the kid goes, oh, I get it. The guy that doesn't have soot on his face, because he sees the guy with soot on his face. And the rabbi says, no, obviously the guy with soot on his face, because he can taste it. It's in his eyes. It's in his mouth, of course. So he's going to wash it off his face. And then he says, he's like, all right, I got one more for you. He's like, it's a different story. He's like, this is how it is. He says, two guys come down a chimney. One guy has soot on his face. The other guy doesn't have soot on his face. Who washes his face? And the kid goes, well, the one guy washes his face for this reason, and the other guy washes his face for this reason. And the rabbi goes, no, you don't get it. You don't understand the mysteries of God. He's like, they obviously both wash their face. How can you go down a chimney and not think that you got soot on your face? You're going to wash your face. And he says, you just don't understand the wisdom and absurdity and whatnot of God. And the idea is that this story is like, we're constantly trying to grasp things. We're constantly trying to know things, but we're basically just entering into a story that's been going on for millennia that's repeating, and we're kind of just participants in this, and that there's this absurdity, there's this excess, there's this more than, and you can't ever fully grasp it. To try to seek to truly understand, you know, the mysteries of God or the mysteries of the transcendent or whatever is completely beside the point. And I just love that idea. And there's a shitload of those other kind of rabbinic tales. But my homie Peter Rollins came on our podcast and told us that, and I thought that was fucking brilliant. And that kind of fit to what Jacob was just saying, I thought.
Can I simplify that to say, if you try to understand God, you're always going to be wrong?
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's the arrogance that you think that you can try to understand God, and that you can ask that question as like a young kid. You're like, I'm going to understand the mysteries of God, or I'm going to understand philosophy, or I'm going to understand the meaning of death. Right? Or I'm going to understand the meaning of whatever, rather than kind of just realizing that it's far more complex and that life is kind of absurd and you have to kind of embrace that absurdism.
What do you guys think about the fantasy sequences?
Why don't you go for it, Kevin?
You know, I was struggling a bit with that today when I was taking notes. I didn't really take any notes during those sections because I wasn't sure what to make of it. I mean, obviously, they're chock full of symbolism. Like, for instance, there's a tie-in where at the end of the second one, the nihilists are in those red suits chasing the dude with giant scissors. And in an earlier scene, a similar like red background painting with giant scissors is in Maud's apartment.
Oh, I didn't see that.
And there's a lot of little things like that where, and that was something else I wanted to bring up and I was excited to bring up, is there are a lot of instances of the dude taking something from his environment and then repeating it or applying it later. So like in the very beginning, on the TV, George H.W. Bush is saying this aggression will not stand. And later in the movie, the dude says, this aggression will not stand, man. And like, it's way later. It's not like the next scene. But if you're paying attention, there are like a few different moments where, like with the scissors and with the aggression will not stand. There's one with the Chinaman too, but the Big Lebowski repeats that.
The Chinaman took me from in Korea. Like there's a lot of these beautiful, like I call them the ping pongs. There's a name for that. Like when they're called,
like a callback.
Yeah, it's like a callback. They're called earlier on and then repeated later. But you get them even with Walter when he says, what was the one I just thought of? Anyway, I can't remember.
My favorite one is when...
Oh, Johnson.
my favorite one is when Maud says, I don't remember what exactly she said, but she says the parlance of our times.
Yes.
And then the dude uses
it
but he uses it wrong. He says, a young trophy wife in the parlance of our times, which makes no sense.
Yeah, when he's in the limo.
Yeah.
Young trophy wife, in the parlance of our times. Yeah, you just, there's a lot of those. And that's just beautiful script writing, which we should talk a bit about Ethan Coen and just sort of his script writing is so precise. I don't know if it's a shooting script or just like an annotated script after the fact. But even Brandt has some repeated lines. He says something like, "Without the like little kids, without the necessary means for the necessary means for the," and he repeats that.
You
phrase,
think that was in the script?
Well, it's written in the script that I found online. I don't know if that's a shooting script or they just took captions after the fact. But my thinking is that they're so precise. These filmmakers,
I've heard they are.
Ryan
used to live with a guy who was a PA on pretty much every big Hollywood movie, and he worked on Hail Caesar. And he says that working on a Coen Brothers set is the simplest, it's the greatest set to work on because they have everything meticulously planned out. They know exactly what time they're shooting. They know exactly where the camera's going to be. They know exactly what lens they're going to use. They know exactly who's going to say what.
They've already rehearsed over and over.
And instead of like your average 14 to 16 hour day, apparently they're done in a solid 9 hours, which is unheard of, which is pretty awesome. But back to the fantasy sequences, this time what I noticed, and maybe I'm overthinking this, but I feel like in the first fantasy sequence when Maud's goons punch him and then he's floating through Los Angeles and he sees Maud fly away on a rug, I feel like even in that 1 second where he saw Maud, it's established that he's sexually attracted to her because then he's like in the bowling lane and the bowling ball goes over him. And it's hard for me not to think of it as phallic, especially because in the second one,
The ball, it's whatever. It's
gutter balls. It's a porno starring him and Maud. So that's something I hadn't thought about the first time.
Interesting. I just love the simplicity of his unconscious, right? Like when he's knocked out, he's thinking about like flying and bowling.
And sex.
Yeah, and sex, yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of it, man.
Did you guys notice the cameos? This is my first, this is crazy, my first time seeing Flea as one of the nihilists, Flea from the Chili Peppers, who I've met a couple times here in the parking lot. And then Amy Mann as the girl with her toe clipped off. I remember Amy Mann, but I didn't know Flea was one of the nihilists. And he's the one who's like, we do not care.
Oh, and it would be remiss of us not to mention that the nihilists are based off of my favorite band of all time, Kraftwerk.
Right. Autobahn.
The LP that is in Maud's house is called Autobahn, and Autobahn is the name of probably the most famous Kraftwerk song. And they're even wearing the red shirts with black ties, which is
the robots.
Well, yeah, from the Man Machine album. That's the costume that they're wearing. So that's always been another reason why I love the movie
so
much. This
movie is just perfect. It's just, man.
It's crazy good. It started a religion. It's got probably a bar themed after it in every major city.
I mean, if the philosophy is that there's like that comedy is kind of just going to keep rolling through time, and that there's just kind of like this tumbleweed that will just keep blowing throughout time or something like that. And I feel like the film is kind of like that tumbleweed, like as its own artifact. Like, maybe it was a film that was a little bit ahead of its time, but I feel like in 50 years, 100 years, this film will still have a sort of resonance, because it's kind of an out-of-place film, because it's detailing an out-of-place dude in a world that doesn't quite operate according to a similar logic, and people are always going to be drawn to that because they're going to be fascinated by it. So I think the film will always be fascinating for that very same reason.
Cool. Kevin, is there anything else you want to bring up before we go into the mailbag?
Gosh, I'm trying to think. Oh, yes. Bars are everywhere. Why is there a bar everywhere that the dude goes? That was something else that I thought of watching it today. I mean, there's a bar, even in the scene where the Big Lebowski is crying in front of the fireplace, he has like this tray that's a bar right behind him. And you'd think that like it's just an excuse to get the dude a drink in every scene, but he doesn't get a scene in that one, yet there's still a bar there. So one thing I was thinking about is that you have all of these disparate characters that kind of have nothing in common except alcohol. I don't know. That was the one through line I felt like all of these people whose philosophies clash and whose backgrounds clash and whose life goals clash have in common is booze.
Had Kahlua. Who has Kahlua?
Well, I think another thing is that I think
even Jackie Treehorn.
I know, right.
I think noir films, alcohol and just drinking, just hard liquor. In every detective's office, there's what's the word I'm looking at? It's probably a tumbler and a...
Yeah, it's like a flask. It's not a flask, like a big... But it's usually probably
a carafe,
like scotch whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. There's always in a the decanter, corner of the
decanter.
Office.
A decanter. There you go.
But here it's like a nice... right. It's a decanter. But then here it's just like... But now it's a white Russian with creamer and...
Yeah, that's what's
Kahlua
so great.
And...
He doesn't drink whiskey or fucking brandy or anything like that. He drinks a white Russian.
And who drinks white Russians? Yeah,
I actually wonder, you know how I think, I don't think it was on the podcast, but we were talking about how the movie Sideways like really permanently damaged the Merlot brand.
Yeah, Merlot business, yeah.
Yeah, because of that line, I'm not drinking Merlot. I have to believe the people at Kahlua literally pray to this movie every day because it catapulted their drink into a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
And the drinks define the characters too, because there's a scene where they're all at the bar at the bowling alley, and the dude is drinking his Caucasian. Donnie is drinking a soda, and Walter's drinking a beer. And then that's when the stranger, Sam Elliott, comes back and orders the sarsaparilla.
Yeah, that's great. All right, let's move into the mailbag. Before we do that, guys, you got to check out Kevin's podcast. It's called The Create Unknown, where he has in-depth conversations with the hottest YouTubers. Kevin, anything else you want to say about it?
We've got a bunch of episodes up already, a lot on the way. Just released one with iDubbbz. We have Jake from Vsauce 3, Smarter Every Day, Dolan Dark and Grande, and Michael from Vsauce will be coming up next.
Awesome.
Oh, nice.
All right, so I did not have time to write down the mailbag questions today, but Austin, I believe, has his email set up. Do you have questions for us, Austin?
Yeah, I got a couple for us. So... the first one comes from Jack, and it is about Walkabout. So he said, "Hey guys, first I wanted to say thanks for covering Walkabout on the show. I feel Australian movies don't get enough overseas attention. I was also happy to hear an appreciation for Australian New Wave, as I feel like it's overlooked at times. When I watched this movie for film studies, along with Wake and Fright and They're a Weird Mob, we looked at them through the lens of films made by international directors reflecting their view of Australia and its culture. Does this change how you look at these movies like it does for me, or do you still see them as just Australian movies? Also, when you see an Aussie film, do you think of it as an international movie because our two cultures are similar, or is it just me thinking that American movies are familiar because of the cultural output of the United States?"
Well, Austin, I feel like as a American living in Australia, you're probably best equipped to answer this question.
Well, I mean, so the interesting thing is I do think that there's something really fascinating about a foreigner telling a story about a particular culture that a lot of times can be very illuminating, right? Like we talked about it a little bit last week with regards to, you know, a Black American filmmakers making films about slavery versus somebody like McQueen who makes a film about slavery and how it's going to be different. And then versus, right. you know, a white dude who makes a film about slavery and it's going to be different. There's something about not being immersed in a given culture that gives you a different perspective, that gives you an outside lens. I mean, when I see Wake and Fright, I view it as an Aussie film, but I view it as an Aussie film because it's so ingrained in Australian cinema culture that I forget sometimes that it's made by somebody who's an international director. And then similar with Walkabout. Like, I mean, the dude's English, right? Nicholas Rogue was English. So,
yeah.
And he changes a little bit from the short story or from the novel that it's based on, because I don't think that originally the main character is supposed to be English, but he makes him English in this story again. So, you know, there is something interesting about that clash of cultures that I think adds to the viewing experience. But yeah, I still view Wake and Fright and The Walkabout as Australian films. And maybe that's to my detriment. Maybe it's because I do view the culture so similar to, I view kind of like Australia as being like so different than America, but kind of similar, that it's speaking in a similar language, but nevertheless, that difference. And anytime I see that difference on display, I just kind of like automatically give it like the status of the foreign. I don't know. What do you think?
All right, so we got a – you want to read it, Jacob?
We got a question coming in from YouTube, by the way. Yay, Wisecrack, what's your favorite Jeff Bridges film? Thanks, Sam Albright.
Well, I mean, I hate to disappoint you, Sam, but it's got to be this movie. other Jeff Bridges movies, I mean, it's not the one where he played a demon hunter with Ryan Reynolds, I can tell you that.
No, and not True Grit, probably.
Fuck, what's the name? I just totally forgot.
Oh, The Last Picture Show is pretty good. That's a long time ago.
Oh, God.
What film?
That was even him. The Last Picture Show.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Last Picture Show.
That's right.
It's got to be Lebowski for me.
Yeah.
Well, because I don't think of The Last Picture Show as being a Jeff Bridges film.
I can't even watch other Jeff Bridges movies without thinking about the dude.
I know. That's just who he is now. Kevin, any other favorite Jeff Bridges movies?
There's a Peter Weir movie with Jeff Bridges in it. About a plane crash. I can't remember its name.
No, I mean, I did really like True Grit personally, but I'm literally Googling Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, and Crazy Heart was pretty good. That's a long time ago. That was pretty good.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we're all in agreement on this one with Lebowski.
Yeah, I think that's it.
All right, you got another one, Austin?
Yeah, so hold on. This one kind of goes back a little bit, but this one is from Strawberry Satire. It's about Mean Girls. Strawberry Satire says, hello, longtime YouTube viewer, first-time podcast listener. Think you're all killing it. Listened to your Mean Girls review and found myself agreeing with the Foucault connection and think it is most exemplified, or it most exemplified the musical, specifically the song I'd Rather Be Me. And then the lyrics are, we're supposed to all be ladies and be nurturing and care. Is that really fair? Boys get to fight. We have to share. Here's the way that turns out. We always understand how to slap someone down with our underhand. And then the comment goes back to comment. There's an odd backfire of female socialization where when denied the approval to be outwardly aggressive, women will turn to social manipulation and passive-aggressive conversation. The only way to destroy the master's house is not with the master's tools, or as the song goes on to sing, quote again, here's my right finger to how girls should behave. And then hope you're all having a good time wherever you are.
Wait, is this Mean Girls on Broadway or something?
It must be.
Okay. Oh, awesome. Interesting.
Yeah. But I thought that was interesting. I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The idea of different standards and stuff like that with regards to how women behave and then how women are portrayed, especially young teenage girls. And we talked about it on the podcast, too, that the film is kind of like – it's kind of what? Like a metaphorical take about animal nature and like the jungle and the safari and shit like that, right?
Right. Yeah, 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 yeah. But it is interesting, I feel like, that they take something that is more of a deep cut reading of the film and make it explicit in the stage adaptation. That's really interesting.
Hmm.
Anyway, so guys, if you want to send us other emails, hit us up at movies@wisecrack.co. Also, you can hit us up with a voicemail at 21ElfGut07.
Yeah, that's our catchy phone number. 21ElfGut07.
Or 213-534-8807. We got some voicemails here. This first one is from, who should we do? Let's go, Jake. Go, Jake.
Hey, Wisecrack. This is Jake calling from the middle of nowhere, Michigan. I was just listening to your Django Unchained podcast, and I thought it was interesting. I was listening to the part where can't remember who was talking about the scenes where Django's killing all those people and their blood is splattering all over these like white symbols, like the cotton and the white horse. And the takeaway was that was a symbol of Django assassinating white supremacy. And I thought it was interesting because I had a different take on that. And I could sort of see a double meaning. So what I took away from it was all these symbols that represent white society and white power now have blood on them. It's almost like there's blood on everything that the white man touches. Everything from the cotton, which is an industry used to subjugate black people, to the horses, which were brought over by Europeans to essentially exterminate Native Americans living there. So anyway, I thought it was a really interesting take on it, and I thought it was interesting that there might be a double meaning there. Love what you guys are doing. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
Thank you, Jake. Yeah. I think that there's just as much validity to that reading as what we were saying. I think that's really interesting. Mm. Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this next one is coming from Devin. Go, Devin.
Hey, Weisbach team. This is Devin. I'm calling in regards to the Django Unchained Show Me the Meaning episode. I wanted to call in because I was kind of overhearing some of the talk about what the meaning behind the movie is and all that kind of stuff. One thing I think you guys may have not really talked about or sort of alluded to was the kind of individualism of Django, and sort of, I think Austin mentioned something about there was some intellectual who wrote an article about, you know, how, you know, Django's not really like a Nat Turner figure. It's not a communal thing. It's this individual who rises up. But I think the thing that most people are missing about the movie, one thing that they forget is really about the mythology of movies and how it sort of shapes our cultural perspective. In terms of the last 100 years or so before Django was made, the typical mythological hero has always been a white guy, whether that's John Wayne or Clint Eastwood. And I think the movie is putting, is sort of taking that figure and replacing it with this black slave, and I think that's a powerful image in and of itself. But on top of that, I think some people are a little bit wrong about Schultz sacrificing himself for Django. I think he's at the end there, he was pretty selfish and left Django in a lurch, and then of course Django has to make the choice to or he's forced in a situation where he needs to truly become a hero on his own.
All right, I'm going to cut it off there. If you guys can send us these voicemails, keep doing it. Keep them snappy if you can. But what do you think about that, guys?
I think it's an interesting take on it. I mean, I think that's exactly – I mean, I haven't seen Django in a while. I wasn't on the podcast last week, but this idea of subverting the hero or creating an all-new hero seems to be kind of what I took away from the film overall anyway. It's kind of where I saw that hero of Django as this sort of unexpected character being the
The fastest gun in the West. We don't usually think of a black slave.
No, and it's revenge. You know, the revenge story of it being so satisfying.
Rock and roll. Let's do one more. Let's go, Matt.
Hi, Wisecrackers. This is Matt from Atlanta calling for the Show Me the Meaning podcast. Was calling with two particular comments I had regarding your recent broadcast about Django. The first was a quick comment on Dr. Schultz's death. I don't really see it as being a sacrifice in any way, shape, or form, because they were almost out the door. His murder of Candy is more an act of pride and self-destructive. It sets Django back, actually, and forces him to escape again. And I think that might be, this may be an overreach, a comment on white liberalism and acting in its pride and acting at the wrong time, and how everything that occurs after that fact is reflective of Black empowerment.
All right, I'm going to stop him there. So, yeah, Austin, you mentioned that there was a sacrifice going on, and that was something that I didn't quite see. So what do you think about that?
I think that's an interesting take. It's funny that both of the two callers picked up on the same thing, that he actually kind of did a selfish thing, and it actually fucks Django. And then Django has to scrape himself up from a shitty situation that he's been dug into. I think that's a really interesting take. I like exploring all of these different things, and I think that if the resonance is there, then we can talk about it, and that's fun. So I think that that's really interesting. Yeah.
Matt was talking about the possible way to interpret the criticism of white liberals. There's another part in the movie in which that crossed my mind, and it's when Schultz first brings Django into the bar when Django has his first beer. He says something like, "I hate slavery, but since I just bought you and I need your help, I'm going to use slavery to my advantage." And then he says, "But I feel guilty."
right.
And I feel like if ever there was Tarantino overtly winking at like people who think that feeling guilty is enough or really doing anything.
Yeah, it's a sort of subversion of the white savior mentality, right?
Yeah, right. So funny. All right, guys. Well, we're going to go and wrap it up for today. Just to let you guys know, definitely check out the Create Unknown, Kevin's podcast. If in-depth conversation with all these YouTubers who are apparently more famous than me since I haven't been invited on the podcast. But we love working with Kevin. He was actually our first collab way back in the day.
Kevin, we did a video on...
So thank you, sir, for that.
Yeah, thanks for joining, man. Hope you had a good time today.
I did. I mean, I was really excited to talk about this movie because I love it so much. So this was a great opportunity, and thanks, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can check out that first collab we did. Kevin hosted and wrote a video on our channel about his favorite book, which came up today on the podcast, which was The Confederacy of Dunces, Ignatius Riley.
And by the way, Kevin, whenever I see my aunt, she still talks about you and how nice you were and how that was such a fun experience for her.
That was a separate video. That I could have gotten leprosy from.
You're right. You survived, though. Yeah, my aunt... cooked armadillo for Kevin.
Yeah, we did a video on, was it five food weird foods that artists ate or something?
Yeah, I actually really love that video of yours, Kevin. I think it turned out great.
Me too. Yeah, that was a lot of fun, and your aunt is a doll. And I was super nervous about eating the armadillo because supposedly you can get leprosy from it, which thankfully I did not. So,
like leprosy? Actually leprosy?
Yes.
Like, yeah. If it's not cooked right.
Yeah, so like, because Kevin's out in New York, and we were like, how are we going to get this food? And Jared's like, my aunt is super nice, and I'm sure she'll cook it. I don't know where she got the armadillo from.
She had to order it. And I was like, yeah, she's retired. She doesn't have anything better to do.
Yeah, so she had a really good time. And so she made, yeah, check out that video. It's very funny on Kevin's channel on Vsauce 2.
Cool. All right, guys, signing off from Hollywood, California. Peace, guys.
Thanks so much.